All rise. The Chief Judge and the judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Good morning.
Morning.
Mr. Pence, it's good to see you again. I understand you're reserving 5 minutes. Is that correct?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. And Captain Rutkowski, are you ready to argue also?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Mr. Pence, you may, in the court of United States versus Captain Narula.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This appeal presents to the court the competing interest of the protections granted under Military Rule of Evidence 404B and the military's preference for joinder of offenses. More specifically, this case presents the challenge of ensuring an accused is not unduly prejudiced by other wrongs or acts which would not otherwise be admissible, but are nevertheless charged and become admissible merely because they are charged. Captain Narula was charged with aggravated sexual assault under Article 120 for having sex with a female while she was sleeping, an offense for which he could have received 30 years. At the same time, he was charged with four far less serious offenses, but all of which involved some type of sexual contact with different females. This included two specifications of conduct unbecoming for kissing and making inappropriate comments to an airman, two different airmen, one charge of fraternization for having sexual relations with an enlisted person, a charge to which he pled guilty, and one charge of sexual assault by touching a civilian female through her clothing as she was walking up the stairs of his apartment. The charges were brought in sequence, with the original charge being brought in February of 08, the two additional charges following on in lesser charges following on in March of 08 and August of 08, the trial in December of 08. The pertinent facts surrounding the aggravated sexual assault are these. Captain Narula and the victim, First Lieutenant K.R., voluntarily met at a bar one evening in August of 2008. The two voluntarily became intoxicated. Your Honor, I may correct myself. The charges were followed on in 09. It's February of 09. I think I'd said 08 because the offense was actually in August of 08. They voluntarily met at a bar one evening in August of 08. The two voluntarily became intoxicated and proceeded to Captain Narula's apartment. While there, they both voluntarily engaged in kissing and petting. They consensually removed one another's clothing and got into Captain Narula's bed naked together. The two engaged in consensual sexual intercourse in various positions from both the rear position and with First Lieutenant K.R. on her back. Following consensual sex, both voluntarily went to sleep together, naked, in Captain Narula's bed. A few hours later, the parties engaged in sexual intercourse again, and is at this point that the testimony materially conflicts. Captain Narula claimed in a statement made to investigators and entered into evidence that he and Lieutenant Rucker engaged in consensual sex again. First Lieutenant K.R. testified that she woke up only
counsel,
to...
I think we're fairly familiar with the facts of this case. If you would just address why you think that this case should have been severed, why these charges should be severed, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor. This appeal asserts that the evidence of other wrongs was impermissibly used by the government to unduly prejudice the members in convicting Captain Narula of the aggravated sexual assault of Lieutenant K.R.
Was there a spillover instruction given?
There was, Your Honor. This is especially so given that the evidence surrounding the allegations itself of aggravated sexual assault was insufficient to support a verdict of guilty. Combined with trial counsel's repeatedly referencing...
I'm sorry, let me just stop you once more. That's where your second, the third issue you're going to argue is, right?
It is coming.
The legal factual sufficiency of...
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Trial counsel...
Just to get the legal landscape here, if we were in issue three, if we were to find, for whatever reason, the evidence was not factually sufficient to support conviction on charge one, would that render issues one and two that you're arguing today moot, since those both relate to charge one?
Yes, Your Honor. Oh. And if the court is inferring I can stop now, I will do so.
No. argue whatever you want. But
thank you, Your Honor.
I'll just make sure I understood how the
I understand.
Because we're not talking about the other charges as far as severance. It's just charge one, right?
Charge one is the serious offense, and that is the one. Obviously, the other remaining charges are 1 to 2 year offenses.
Right.
Counsel, can I ask you real quick, what is the standard of review that we use for the severance issue?
Your Honor, there was no motion filed for severance, and I believe the standard will be plain error. Combined with trial counsel's repeatedly referencing the separate charges as one and his misstatement of the law, the members were misled and wrongfully convicted Captain Rula of aggravated sexual assault. It is acknowledged that these errors went without objection. Nevertheless, the errors were egregious and prejudiced Captain Rula to the extent that his conviction should be overturned.
Don't mean to interrupt your flow again, but as Chief Judge Brand alluded to, there was a spillover instruction as well as other instructions by the judge. And as you know, members are presumed to follow the instructions, regardless of whether the argument was over the line or not. Wouldn't the presumption that the members followed the law cure that?
No, Your Honor. And we will address that, but I want the court to understand, if it were that alone, if it were the spillover instruction alone, that would do it. But there were a combination of things that happened here that caused the spillover instruction to be particularly misused and described in a wrongful way to the members, where I do not believe it's possible, when taken as a whole, when you look at the spillover instruction, the 404B that was actually introduced, the statement of the law as it was given to the members, and the evidence here, the specific nuances, that these combine together, where the members, and even now we would submit the government's argument today is in error with the court. And if I could follow through on that, I will illuminate that. As cited in our brief, the records replete with the government lumping all the charges together as substantially one offense. I'd like to cite just one example. The spillover between offenses is most clearly demonstrated in the questioning of Airman Brittany Ritchie. Now, Airman Ritchie was the female involved in the 134 offense of fraternization with whom Captain Narula admittedly had sexual relations. Those relations were consensual, and Captain Narula pled guilty to that offense. Despite his guilty plea, the government called Airman Ritchie to testify in their case in chief, ostensibly to testify about some bloody sheets at his apartment, and that Captain Narula had lied to her about the source of that blood. Setting aside for the moment whether that testimony was relevant, the government engaged in what was clearly designed to have an improper spillover effect. And let me explain. When Airman Ritchie was called to the stand, trial counsel said before the members, ask Airman Ritchie to identify Captain Narula, and she did. Question, are you the Airman Ritchie that is named in the charge that we have before this court for fraternization of Captain Narula? Airman Ritchie answered yes. Knowing that Captain Narula had already pled guilty to that offense, trial counsel then states in front of the members, quote, okay, we are not here really to talk about that charge. We have some other issues to deal with, end quote. Nevertheless, moments later, the government proceeds to elicit from Airman Ritchie the fact that she had sexual relations with Captain Narula. Trial counsel asks Airman Ritchie, quote, now, did you eventually engage in a relationship with Captain Narula? End quote. Answer, yes. Trial counsel then asked, without going into specifics, you did, right? Airman Ritchie, yes. Your Honors, the very question indicates that trial counsel knows the specifics of the relationship between Captain Narula and Airman Ritchie, to which Captain Narula has already pled guilty, are not relevant to the remaining charges, including the aggravated sexual assault.
But nevertheless, the defense asked that the members be informed of that plea, right?
What's that?
Didn't the defense ask that the members be informed of the plea?
Your Honor, there is nothing wrong with being informed of the plea. It is the specifics of the plea, which is indicated by trial counsel. He knows without getting into the specifics. But the very next question says by trial counsel, quote, okay, did that end up becoming a sexual relationship? To which Airman Ritchie, yes, yes. This testimony was solicited and admitted despite the fact that Captain Narula's sexual relationship with Ritchie could in no way be relevant to the charge of aggravated sexual assault or any of the others.
Well, I suppose it might provide some context to the, I don't want to call it a confrontation, let's call it a discussion about when Airman Ritchie comes over to Captain Narula's house for, I think it was her birthday or something like that, for a visit, and notices blood on the sheets and says, hey, what's going on here? And so it would provide some context, wouldn't it, for that statement?
Your Honor, I would disagree with the court in that it would provide any proper context. It could only be used, in, from what I could see, to show you had sexual relations at an, with another female. Clearly, he'd already pled guilty to that. Your Honor, it gets more aggravating, and the reason I'm pointing out Richie is because it goes to our next argument that I will make. Combined with the arguments made by trial counsel, which we're going to address here in a moment, we submit this was plain error. In both opening statement and closing argument, members were misled by trial counsel's continued grouping of the charges, being collectively referred to as a violation of boundaries and a reality versus fantasy. Trial counsel's opening statement, he said, in the government's case, you'll hear and see the reality of what happened to four independent female victims on four separate occasions. But in closing argument, the cases were not treated as independent at all. And this is where it comes in, Your Honor, where all of these things play together, where a members of the jury could not possibly have kept up with what is a spillover instruction and what is a mistake of fact instruction, which are both issues in this case. Trial counsel stated, quote, essentially, this is a case about boundaries. And over the summer months of 2008, Captain Narula shows himself to be a man who does not understand boundaries, end quote. Trial counsel then proceeds to state how each offense crossed this boundary, clearly relating one to another. When violating boundaries is not charged, it could have been charged as a whole. There, I see the situation where you could have charged a conduct unbecoming in a series of offenses, and he acted so egregious in all those, but that was not the case here. These were independent, separate offenses that bled over into one another. But, members of the panel, most confusing and telling is the trial counsel's argument regarding the applicability of the spillover instruction given by the court and what it means. This has been addressed in my brief, and the government has responded accordingly, but the government's response actually brings clarity to the appellant's position. At page 9 of the government's brief, they cite the record where trial counsel in closing referenced the spillover instruction and the need to consider the offenses separately. In particular, the government gives two examples, one at page 591 and the other at 594. But these examples actually show the misleading nature of the government's argument of the spillover instruction. Please let me explain. At page 591 of the record, which is cited in the government's appellate brief, the trial counsel states, you cannot use one offense that you find him guilty of to find him guilty of another offense. And that is a correct statement of the law. But a review of that statement reveals that trial counsel is only referring to the two specifications of the conduct unbecoming charged in count two. But even at that, trial counsel follows on with this statement, quote, but because the conduct is so similar, what I want to do is explain to you why it is conduct unbecoming, end quote. The very fact that trial counsel would emphasize that the conduct is so similar with why it's conduct unbecoming indicates that the government is ignoring the spillover instruction and that the members should do likewise. Even more confusing is the government citation, the trial counsel statement at 594, where the trial counsel emphasized that, quote, just because you may find him guilty of one of those specifications doesn't necessarily mean that he may be guilty of the second. And they have inserted in there the dots of language left out. But if you have a complete reading of that sentence, it demonstrates that trial counsel is telling the members that the spillover instruction applies only to conduct unbecoming. The entire sentence reads as follows. Just because you may find him guilty of conduct unbecoming on one of those occasions doesn't mean that he may be guilty of conduct unbecoming on the second occasion. That is what the spillover means, end quote. Members are clearly left with the impression that the spillover instruction applies to the two specifications of conduct unbecoming.
Was there an objection made?
There was no objection made.
Do we not consider that fact in evaluating whether the argument crossed the line? I mean, there's people down there on the field trying this case and listening to it.
Your Honor,
everything in view, and I'm sure you've seen the affidavits of the trial defense counsel, and you know that person's a very experienced person in the courtroom. Isn't that something we should consider?
Absolutely, and the court must consider that, and I don't doubt that that is going to be done. But there comes a point where the trial counsel is going to miss a few things. But that's why the judge is there. There comes a point where the judge, when seeing an error, especially, for instance, with the example of Airman Ritchie's testimony, testifying about the specifics of her sexual relations, we submit there comes a time where the judge must intervene and say, wait. Your Honor, and if I could, This ties in with the next argument I'm about to make, which is on the instructions of mistake of fact, which we think is a fatal error here, because these were combined in closing argument. The spillover effect suggested by the trial counsel is so prejudicial in this case because the factual situations which the parties, having engaged in consensual sex, talking of future sex, laying together naked in bed, as well as Captain Nula's defense that he believed he had consent to have sex, is so nuanced that any spillover from one or more minor offenses could certainly negatively impact Captain Nula. Let me clarify. The government wrongfully argued to the members that the law did not allow Captain Nula to have a mistake of fact defense. At page 619 of his closing argument, the trial counsel argued, if you believe KR was asleep when he climbed on top of her, you know it doesn't even matter. It doesn't even matter if when she woke up she enjoyed it. If she woke up and said, keep going, big boy, it doesn't matter. If she said, thank you for an orgasm, as soon as she was asleep and his penis penetrated her vagina, we are done. He broke the law, regardless of what she thought about it later and regardless of what she did before. Trial counsel then proceeds to make a similar argument using the example of a husband and wife who have been married for 10 years and having sex 5 times a week, clearly inferring that even then a husband is guilty of aggravated sexual assault if he has sex with his sleeping wife. That is not a correct statement of the law. If as a result of their prior consensual behavior and all other surrounding circumstances, Captain Nula reasonably believed that he had consent to have sex again with a sleeping Lieutenant KR, he had a legitimate mistake of fact offense and entitled to an acquittal. This was so completely negated by the government's argument with no intervention from the court.
But the military judge did instruct on the mistake of fact defense, correct?
We did, Your Honor, and we have those instructions. But again, if you look at how those are lumped together and how quickly they go, we believe that actually the way the instructions read, it looks almost like conflicting instructions. They're both correct statements of the law. But one instruction says a person cannot consent to sexual activity if that person is substantially incapacitated, a correct statement of the law, but it clarifies that with or tries to qualify it with a mistake of fact. We believe that the argument of trial counsel, combining the spillover, combining the mistake of fact together, so misled the jury that there's no way they could possibly have known about this mistake of fact. Perhaps most aggravating is when trial counsel is making, Perhaps most aggravating is when trial counsel is making this argument about the husband and wife I've told you about and the wife having sex multiple times. He gratuitously in his closing argument inserts this. Well, quote, well, just for an example, maybe not even married. You have Brittany Ritchie. Now, that's the airman victim of the fraternization. You have Brittany Ritchie. She has had sex with him several times, at least 5 times a week from what she told you, but let's go with the married couple. That is a gratuitously inserting of 404B evidence, prior misconduct, into a mistake of fact instruction. Clearly the wrong place to do it, clearly prejudicial, and clearly not supported in the record. There is not a place in the record where Brittany Ritchie said she had sex at least 5 times or had 5 times a day or a week with Captain Nula. I don't know where trial counsel got that information. It is not in Brittany Ritchie's testimony. Brittany Ritchie, of course, is the female that was the subject of the fraternization charge. Trial counsel not only misstates the law here, but deliberately inserts irrelevant but highly prejudicial evidence to make his point. Trial counsel repeats this error at 6:20 when he tells the member that the acts of KR that evening, regardless of how, and these are his words, egregious or serious the acts of KR were, should only be considered by the members at sentencing. Clearly the acts of Lieutenant KR that evening would be relevant for members to consider in determining whether or not Captain Nula held a reasonable mistake of fact regarding consent.
Well, it's got to be honest and reasonable.
It has, yes, Your Honor, it does.
Well, let me ask you about that. Let's say that under the circumstances, the reasonableness, I want to go to the subjective, the honest mistake. What evidence do we have of the appellant's honest mistake? He didn't testify, which obviously he didn't have to, but what evidence do we have that he held an honest mistake of fact, along with a reasonable mistake?
Your Honor, I can only cite to the record and the facts that preceded the event. Our argument is that this entire idea of a deliberation on mistake of fact was taken away from him by closing argument. Even using the government's argument now, which I'm about to get into, you will see that mistake of fact, there, under the government's theory, there can never be a mistake of fact if someone is sleeping, period, end of story.
And how, in fact, is that how the military judge instructed, though?
That is not how the military judge instructed. But, Your Honor, when you look at the totality of the circumstances here, it is clearly what the impression of the members, and that's what we're talking about. Finally, just to complete the statement of the trial counsel when he's given this misstatement, finally he says, she, KR, is not on trial, HS is not on trial, ND is not on trial, DF is not on trial. Again, trial counsel combining all the various charges into what is a clearly misstatement of the law. And that is, it's enough, he's a bad person, he's done a lot of bad things, you should convict him. The government on appeal actually repeats this argument, stating at the brief at page 27, if Captain K.R. was asleep at the moment of penetration began, this was aggravated sexual assault. There's no authority for that. In fact, it is contrary to the government's argument in a pre-trial hearing in this very case, where the trial counsel, defense counsel, and military judge are discussing defense counsel's pre-trial motion. Trial counsel acknowledged, because arguably it could be considered that there would, he said, it could be a considered a position where a woman at some point could give future consent, even though she's passed out. You know, what would really get, if she said, you know, what would really get me going is the thought of you having sex with my passed out body. I mean, there are all kinds of possible sexual type actions that people can take. That's just one of them, consent beforehand. A person can have sex with a substantially incapacitated person, but that substantially incapacitated person could have consented to activity beforehand. The court, this is what I'm saying. If an individual can give consent explicitly beforehand, as the trial counsel acknowledged in a pretrial motion in this case, then if that can be done explicitly, it could be done implicitly with all of the facts. This does not go to the mind of the victim. It goes to the mind of the accused. And that was taken away from Captain Rula by this argument. Trial counsel's blanket assertion that he was guilty of sexual assault at the moment of penetration with no allowance for a mistake of fact is plain error. In conclusion, it would be impossible for the members to know the scope and the applicability of the spillover instruction or the mistake of fact instruction given the arguments of counsel and the nature of the facts in this case. The government's argument in putting these cases together under a common theme is a violation of boundaries, which itself is not an offense, clearly calls to the members to conclude that Captain Arula must be guilty of one or more offenses.
Mr. Pence, you're not saying that the trial counsel had a duty to argue mistake of fact, are you?
Absolutely not. Okay. No, he had a duty to state the law correctly, and he failed in that duty. The evidence of aggravated assault standing alone is insufficient to deny Captain Arula a mistake of fact offense. The government's argument that Captain Arula was not entitled to such a defense is fatal prejudicial error. Finally, these cumulative errors support the appeal of this conviction and warrant a reversal. Thank you.
May it please the court. I am Captain Michael Rakowski, and along with Colonel Don Christensen, we represent the United States. With the court's permission, the government would like to focus its arguments on issues 1 and 3, the severance issue and the ineffective assistance counsel issue, though it certainly stands prepared to answer any questions as to legal and factual sufficiency. As the Supreme Court recently stated in Harrington v. Richter, an ineffective assistance counsel claim...
If I can slow you down just a little bit. Whoa. Would you say that case again, please?
Harrington v. Richter. That's supplemental cite the government filed in this case because it was decided in January. An ineffective assistance of counsel claim can function to escape the rules of waiver and forfeiture, and raise issues not raised at trial. That's precisely what appellant's trying to do here with a severance claim and objection to trial counsel's argument, neither of which were raised at trial and for the first time are brought up on appeal.
So you agree it's plain error?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, the standard's plain error.
Yes, Your Honor. Specifically with issue one, appellant's post-trial severance claim was waived by not being raised at trial, and he's presented no reason why this court should find that the military judge committed plain error for not sua sponte severing the charges on his own. Under the rules for court-martial, joinder of all offenses at a single court-martial is the standard, absent a motion or request for severance. Severance is only granted for manifest injustice, and as demonstrated by the four cases cited by this, the government in its brief, joinder of sexual offenses at a single trial is pretty common in the military justice. Here, the defense needs to meet the plain error standard, and they fail in the first factor of that test, whether it was error at all. In United States v. Burton, our Supreme Court stated that a military judge's sua sponte duty to do a severance is viewed in the context of the entire trial. And they set out several factors for determining that context of the entire trial, which this court applied in United States v. Street for a very similar claim. And the court found that the military judge did not commit plain error and not sua sponte severing a trial of two rapes of two victims 5 years apart. And those factors concern whether the evidence was presented separately, which it was in this case, as detailed by the government's brief. The only witness that talked about charge one and the other charges was Dr. Savidin, and that's because he was referring to the accused's pretrial statements about the charges he was facing at trial. All the other witnesses were presented either on charge one or on the other charges. Moreover, the spillover instruction was not only given by the military judge, was repeated twice by trial counsel and once by defense counsel in their arguments. Finally, there was no objection as to spillover during the arguments. And quite frankly, under the facts of this case, a sua sponte severance by a military judge would make no sense. The judge knows nothing of the facts of the case prior to entry of pleas, which is when a severance would have to occur. The appellant had very experienced defense counsel, and so for all the military judge knows, it could be a tactical decision not to sever, as it was in this case, based on the affidavits of counsel. Quite frankly, asking the military judge to sua sponte sever a case when there's no motion and in those circumstances would be asking him to substitute his judgment for the parties that actually know the facts when the military judge does not know much about the case at that point.
Can I just clarify something that came up in the other argument?
Yes,
in your brief, it does seem to appear, and I guess this is drifting toward the sufficiency of the evidence issue, it does seem to appear that you're arguing that if K.R. was asleep at the time penetration began, then the affirmative defense of mistake of fact as to consent does not exist. Is that what you're arguing?
Your Honor, those words were never actually spoken as for a mistake of fact defense. The actual words the trial counsel used, and we believe it was a correct statement of law, was a condition argument. If she was asleep at the time the penetration occurred, he did specifically say there is no defense of consent, because obviously if she's asleep, she's substantially incapacitated, she cannot consent. As far as mistake of fact, the members had the facts before them to determine whether it was a reasonable mistake, an honest mistake, one that a prudent, sober adult would be making in that
situation.
Well, I
guess I was looking at not trial counsel's argument, but your argument.
Yes, sir.
At the bottom of page 27, going on to the top of 28, you state, and I'll just quote it for you so you can help clarify it. And despite appellant's insistence that he had a mistake of fact defense, appellant's mistake was not an honest and reasonable one, meaning he did not have a defense if, and you have both underlined, italicized, and bolded the word if, so I assume that has some significance. If K.R. was asleep at the time penetration began, unquote.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what does that mean?
Your Honor, based on all the facts that precede page 27, the government would argue under the facts in front of the members at that time, there was no reasonable, honest, prudently sober mistake.
But the legal issue, you're not saying that if someone is asleep at the time sex begins, then by law there can be no affirmative defense. You're not saying that.
No, Your Honor. We're not saying, as far as mistake of fact, as far as consent, we would make
right,
that argument.
The affirmative defense would
yes.
still apply.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And certainly, in a factor brought up by counsel during argument, it's worth pointing out an affirmative defense doesn't deny the criminal act occurred. It just denies criminal right. responsibility. And so certainly the trial counsel making the argument that the crime occurred if she was asleep is a proper argument. Now, whether there was an affirmative defense to deny criminal liability for that issue, that's a separate issue.
I just want to make sure we were tracking.
Yes, Your Honor.
On that. Okay.
Well, counsel, since we're on that, we have to make an independent determination actually as to whether everything you know warrants the guilt of the appellant, right?
Yes, sir.
Correct. Well, let's talk about that. Why wasn't the mistake of fact defense applicable here? Why don't you think that there was sufficient evidence to warrant it? And we know all the facts. As I understand them, it's fairly straightforward. They meet at a bar. They engage in discussions with one another. There's some kissing going on. They leave consensually together. They go to his apartment. They end up in his his bed, she's naked, they have sex, there's no issue at that point whether it was forced, apparently it was consensual. She continues to lie there naked in her in his bed.
I think she testified the first time was consensual.
Yes, she did, Your Honor.
So all of that is an agreement, is that correct?
That's an agreement, yes.
So are you saying that no reasonable person could have believed that all of those factors leading up to that point would lead that individual to believe they could have sex another time in the same circumstances, she's in bed, she's naked, 2 hours later or whatever the actual time frame was?
Your Honor, our argument would be, again, it's very contingent, and that's what the trial counsel made clear. 10 times on the record, he stated, our argument is contingent on she being asleep at the time the penetration occurs. And the government's argument would be, if she is asleep and he begins penetrating her, a reasonably prudent, sober adult would say, I need to at least wake her and say, you want to have sex, not simply just go right in. And
but that
and
seems that you're saying by law, then, the affirmative defense never applies if the alleged victim is asleep.
No, Your Honor. We're making under the specific facts of this case because, again, you have the example of the married couple, something else, whether someone had given express consent previously to say, hey, well, I'm asleep, feel free. But yeah, we don't have that circumstance in
well,
this case.
Most times people don't take their lawyer into the bedroom with them to write a contract. So
certainly
we got to look at the circumstances as they exist.
And in that case, Your Honor, I would point to pages 349 through 352 of the record. There, the victim specifically states that prior to the consensual act, she told the accused she was asleep, she didn't want to have sex, she just wanted to go to sleep. She eventually consented to his request and then said, we both went to sleep. I went to sleep. I woke from my sleep to him penetrating me. Those are pertinent facts for the members to consider.
Well, that's not all that went on, is it? You're not saying that's all that happened that night in the bedroom, is it?
Well, no, Your Honor. Obviously, we stated that she had sexual activity with him prior to that.
She chose to share the bed with him. That's at 384, I believe. They got undressed, consented to French kissing, consented to what she agreed she would describe as heavy petting at 385, consented to digital penetration of her vagina, told the accused, the appellant, that his, quote, fingers are fine, that she had an orgasm, that she consented to sexual intercourse, and in fact agreed, I think this is during cross, consented to everything up to the point where she fell asleep.
Yes, Your Honor.
I guess my question would be, where did she hold up the stop sign?
I believe that, again, when we're considering mistake of fact, and whether it was reasonable, prudent, sober mistake, when someone's asleep, having sexual intercourse with a sleeping person is
okay,
something
that's
not
reasonable. Okay, that's your bylaw argument again. You got to pick one or the other.
No, Your Honor, I'm stating under these facts. Certainly there
under
could be a separate fact scenario where two people have some kind of kinky relationship or something, but under these facts, there's no reasonable anonymous mistake.
Excuse me, a kinky relationship?
Your Honor, I don't know what people do in their bedroom.
Well, we know what happened in this bedroom, and I'm asking you, where was the stop sign?
Your Honor, the moment she fell asleep.
Really?
And that's what we're arguing, based on their relationship at that point.
Okay.
And based on the facts before the members at that point.
So a reasonable person couldn't have believed that all of her actions prior to that point would lead him to believe, yeah, she's interested in going for a second round, if you will.
I don't think a reasonable person, under the facts of this case, with those prior relationship that they had, the short prior relationship, would think it is okay to have sex with her while she is sleeping. Now, certainly, there could be some other strange factual scenario that's not present before this court, but
well,
under these
so
facts...
Well, it's strange about two people getting together, hitting it off, and deciding to have consensual sex together. That happens all the time. That's not unusual. None of the facts of this case are unusual in any way that I can see. I mean, he didn't force her to do it. He may have been insistent. That's a difference of opinion. But maybe he was insistent, but she agreed. So what's unusual about this?
Applies to the prior consensual sex activity, which was not charged.
Cannot the totality of the circumstances that existed that evening and that morning be taken into account to determine whether the second incident was consensual or not?
It can certainly be taken into account, Your Honor. We're just arguing that here those factors were not met.
So you're saying a reasonable person could not have done it?
Under the facts of this case, a reasonable person would not think that it's a reasonable mistake to have sex with a sleeping person.
Just so I'm clear on the standard, the proof must show beyond a reasonable doubt, and we, under our independent power, must be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the affirmative mistake of fact as to consent does not apply.
Correct, Your Honor. And since we're talking about legal and factual sufficiency, the government will point out United States v. Reed, where it was pointed out that proof beyond a reasonable doubt need not be free of all conflict, and specifically United States v. Lips, where this court has stated that when you have a credibility contest between a victim and an accused as to whether an activity was consensual or not, corroborating evidence is a key factor for determining which side is proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, that's a good point, because I didn't mention earlier, I was curious about her reaction before she left the apartment the next morning, because she says that, and this was after, and I'll grant you this is kind of a crass remark, that the appellant told her that she needed to find a new dentist. Probably not the best thing to say at that hour and under that circumstance. But he did not say that he had done anything wrong. This is her testimony. And she says, did not get mad at him at all. And then the sexual assault nurse testified, and I think this was in response to a court member question, that what she labeled as injuries in her report could be consistent with either consensual or non-consensual sex. So the sexual assault kit's a wash.
That is correct, Your Honor. Obviously, the sexual assault kit cannot tell you whether sex was consensual or not. What the government would point out, especially in relation to Lips, is that corroborating evidence of the two individual stories is very important. Here, the accused told four different stories to four different people about the sexual activity that night, and all the physical evidence corroborated what the victim said occurred, most specifically the DNA testing that was done on the condom provided by the accused. In this case, the accused in his statement to OSI stated that on the first sexual act, the consensual act, he wore a condom, he completed, he took the condom off, and then he says later on that night she initiated sexual activity with him and he was not wearing a condom. The condom testing actually showed that her DNA was found inside the condom as worn, which would demonstrate it had occurred during the second sexual act as consistent with the victim's testimony. And it found the blood of the victim on the outside of the condom as worn, which would again be consistent to her claim that she woke, was not consenting to sexual activity at that point, and it was painful along with the damage found during the sexual assault exam. The government would argue that the physical evidence in this case corroborates the victim's testimony rather than the accused of several different versions of.
And I guess that's why I focused on her testimony, because let's just go with what she said. Those are what I picked off to you, what she said.
Correct, Your Honor. Certainly, with the fact that she didn't fight him or anything else, those are all factors you can consider in front of the members, but there's no set requirement that she resist when she's being sexually assaulted during substantial incapacity. Those kind of factors are all things before the members consider, and they did consider in this case. Defense counsel, I believe, even argued all those things in front of the members for them to consider, and they still came back and found that he was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Concerning the ineffective assistance of counsel claim in Issue 3, appellant fails to meet any of the prongs in United States v. Polk for the test determining ineffective assistance of counsel, especially to overcome the strong presumption of competence this court gives counsel under the law. As recently as Richter and as long ago as Strickland, our Supreme Court has consistently stated there are countless ways to provide effective assistance. Even the best defense counsel will not defend the same client in the same way. This court determines whether the conduct was under prevailing professional norms, not whether the counsel's performance was the best or most common practice. Here, the government would argue that there was a reasonable explanation for the counsel's decision not to raise the motion to sever and not to object to trial counsel's argument. Concerning the motion to sever, first, the accused must establish that he had a reasonable probability of success on a motion to sever before it can be held as a basis for error under ineffective assistance of counsel. Here, the government would argue under Southworth and all the severance test issues, the defense does not have a reasonable probability of success had this been raised. Most specifically, the evidence of two of the charges would have been admissible in charge one under the rules as cited in the government's brief. There was a spillover instruction given by military judge, trial counsel, and defense counsel, and there was no objections as to a spillover argument. Even if the evidence was not admissible on some of the charges, under United States v. Duncan, our superior court, and this court in Sanchez del Carpio has stated, that factor alone is not dispositive, does not require severance. Again, similar to the Street case, because that case also dealt with an appellate severance claim that was not raised at trial. The defense counsel in that case raised both practical and tactical reasons why they did not raise the motion. Here we have the same thing with the defense counsel. They raised practical reason that they didn't feel they could meet the manifest injustice standard, and the tactical reason that based on his 30 years of experience, he had gained several acquittals on cases where the government charged one major charge and several minor ones, and he thought he could exploit that to his advantage. Concerning the argument of trial counsel, again, the defense must first show that the argument itself was improper. Appellant has cited to no cases that actually demonstrate this argument was improper. Again, the government would argue it was a proper comparison of four very different charges being summarized at the very beginning of the arguments. If you go back and look, the trial counsel in the opening summarized the four charges and then talked about each one in detail. And in trial counsel's closing, he summarized four charges, each one in detail. These are very short summaries followed by 13 pages and 35 pages of argument by the counsel. The government would state that simply referring to accused inconsistent statements in the opening as fantasy is not error under United States v. Garon, where the accused did make several inconsistent statements. Trial counsel referred to it in opening, and the court upheld the argument as proper. Finally, this nowhere near reaches the argument in United States v. Burton, which was a plain propensity argument. And even in that case, the Superior Court found it was not plain error and not prejudicial based on the other factors in the case. Again, trial counsel had a reasonable explanation, trial defense counsel, reasonable explanation for not objecting to this. He felt it supported his theme that the accused would commit consensual inappropriate behavior, but not would commit a crime of aggravated sexual assault of a sleeping person.
Can I go back to the mistake of fact and all that? Because that's got
my attention.
I'm just looking at the case, U.S. v. Barron, 23 MJ 736, a case decided by this court in 1986, in which a young lady was intoxicated, ultimately had sex with at least three, if not four, individuals. And her argument was that she knew she would not have consented but for being intoxicated. And this court threw out the case because it was insufficient to disprove beyond reasonable doubt the affirmative defense of reasonable and honest mistake of fact to the charge of rape. So I guess my point being that why couldn't, I mean, this court under somewhat similar circumstances, even more so, she was drunk, we could find reasonable and honest mistake. I'm still not sure why we haven't found reasonable and honest mistake here from you're saying, well, under the circumstances, no reasonable person could have found a mistake.
And Your Honor, the government would argue that the testimony in this case and that testimony are in stark contrast. She did not say, I wouldn't have done it but for, or anything. She literally said, I was asleep and woke to vaginal intercourse, him penetrating my vagina. Certainly there's a different situation between being offered the opportunity to consent to something and simply not being even available to consent to something and having it occur. The government would argue that's a stark contrast in this case. Moreover, as again as cited in the government's brief, she had previously told the accused she was going to go to sleep. She wanted to go to sleep prior to that second sexual act. She said they both went to sleep. So the government would argue we have a separate situation than someone that merely regrets having sexual intercourse later because she was drinking. Here she stated she was asleep. Whether the members believe that or not is up to the members, and the government made clear their argument was contingent on the members believing that. They made that their entire theory. And even in motions practice, the defense counsel talked about there's some possible hypotheticals. The government on page 30 of the record specifically stated our argument on substantial incapacity is she was asleep at the time it occurred. And they made it very clear to the members in closing. I believe they brought it up seven times in rebuttal. They brought it up three more times. Their argument was specific that the members find she was asleep at the time the sexual activity, second sexual activity occurred.
All right, but that goes to the elements. Well, the elements as we used to know them, that the government would need to prove some lack of consent.
Well, Your Honor, we also argue it goes to substantial incapacity element the government is now required to prove under the new Article 120,
right.
Certainly different than the previous case.
But again, we're on the side of the government's burden. But that gets you halfway home if there's the other side of the affirmative defense. Then the government has another burden. They have to prove that that does not exist beyond a reasonable doubt. So saying that she's asleep, okay, that gets you halfway there. You met the elements. But if there's evidence that raises an honest and reasonable mistake of fact as to consent, then there's a whole other piece. And that's the government's duty to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that defense does not exist.
Right. Yes, Your Honor, and okay. We certainly understand.
Sleep is not the end of the story.
Yes.
So I'll make sure, going back to my initial question, You're not arguing, as a matter of law, that if she's asleep, then the affirmative defense does not apply.
No, Your Honor. I'm sure there's some hypothetical that this court or someone else could come up with.
It may not even be hypothetical.
Your Honor, and we'd argue under the facts presented to the members in this case, we met that burden. Certainly this court considers the light in the most favorable light to the prosecution.
Yeah, for legal sufficiency.
Yes, Your Honor. As far as factual sufficiency, certainly this court has to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt themselves. We would argue, based on all the evidence presented to the members, there were, I believe, four witnesses that testified as to inconsistent statement the appellant had on this issue. And then there was the several witnesses who talked about the consistency of the victim. We had the physical evidence that corroborated the victim's story and contradicted the appellant's story. We would certainly argue that all the evidence presented, the members and this court could find beyond a reasonable doubt there was a mistake of fact of consent in this specific case. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
You may.
The claims by appellant in this case failed to meet the standards of both plain error and ineffective assistance. Appellant faced trial on multiple charges that were properly joined. He also received effective assistance from experienced civilian and military defense counsel, and the evidence of guilt on charge one was legally and factually sufficient. Accordingly, this court should affirm the findings and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pence?
Thank you, Your Honor.
If I might just briefly address matters that were brought up in the government's rebuttal, specifically, Judge Roan, a question that you had asked and followed by Senior Judge Gregory about bringing of all the facts considered in this case. I believe I heard the government say, well, no, there actually could be a mistake of fact here. And he used an example of, well, maybe if you had a married couple. I want to point out to the court that specific example was used by trial counsel in closing argument that a married couple who had sex five times a week would not be entitled to this defense if there was penetration. That is not the law. I simply want to express to the court that if, as trained jurists, we are struggling with understanding this. How could you expect a jury of well-educated, but nonetheless legally untrained individuals to understand the difference between the instruction which says a one-line mistake of fact that also contains right above it that says a person cannot consent to sexual activity if that person is substantially incapacitated? You can understand where the members might struggle with that, which makes it more important that trial counsel not give them, not on one, two, but on several occasions, a statement which says you cannot have a mistake of fact in this case. That's what the members were told. And in fact, Judge Gregory, as you pointed out, a clear and plain reading of the appellee's own brief indicates that that's the case. And that is not the law. Finally, when you combine this with the spillover instruction, and I think the spillover instruction is probably evidenced most in the fact that the jury came back and rendered a sentence that was in excess of even what the government asked for, you can see that combined together, it is what Judge Gregory has said, is this is very, very crass behavior, undoubtedly, very crass. But we do not convict people on crass behavior alone. Implore the court to review all of the facts and the circumstances in this case. Consider the fact that there was indeed, in fact, spillover improperly, not just during closing argument, during presentation of evidence as demonstrated by Airman Ritchie, with no objection, but with no intervention of the court either, and that Captain Narula was denied a mistake of fact defense. And I respectfully request this court to reverse his conviction as to count one.
I'm interested in your view on how the apparent inconsistencies in Captain Arula's statements play into, if at all, the honest aspect of the honest and reasonable mistake.
Yeah, this is a question that Judge Roan asked, and I believe that it is relevant in this sense. He was not charged with making false statements on several occasions, which he could have been charged. That was never an issue on whether he made false or inconsistent statements. I can only respond to the court in this way with that. Regardless of whether he had several misstatements, he was nonetheless entitled to the correct instruction and a mistake of fact defense. A correct instruction on that and a correct consideration of that by the panel. Judge Gregory, I believe he was denied that, and I believe he was denied that for the very reason we're struggling with understanding, okay, what is the distinction? Can you really, is there a situation where you can have consensual sex with someone who's asleep? It is a very, very confusing issue. All the more reason why it must be clearly delineated by everyone, not just the judge, but by trial counsel's obligation, and that it not be complicated with spillover information. If there are no further questions, I thank the court, and it is an honor, actually, to be before this court on the last hearing in this particular courtroom. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pence. We will take the arguments under advisement and issue our decision in due course, and Mr. Pence stole my thunder. This is going to be the last argument in this courtroom. It's not the last official function in this courtroom. We have one more JSOC class that we will be swearing in prior to our move to Andrews. Thank you for this argument. This court is adjourned.
All rise.